And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest is Michael Vershin. He's the assistant professor at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah. Michael, along with assistant professor Savine Safarian, have received the National Science Foundation Rapid Response Research Grant to study the structure of the SARS-CoV-2, the core coronavirus strain at the center of the pandemic. The physicists will create individual synthetic coronavirus particles without a genome, making the virus incapable of infection or replication. The researchers will test how the structure of the coronavirus withstands changes in humidity and temperature, and under what conditions the virus would fall apart. Michael Vershin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Well, Michael, it's a pleasure to have you because this grant is very exciting. And one of the things that Lynn and I have seen continually over the last 7.5 years with Cool Science Radio is that research used to be sort of standalone islands. There were silos of expertise that work alone. They don't necessarily share their work. They don't necessarily work with other groups. But we continually see this tremendous collaboration going on. And you are in a group which is absolutely fascinating, the Center for Cell and Genome Sciences, where there is a lot of collaboration cross-group. Can you talk about that group?
Yeah, so this is something that is several years old. It has developed over the years where the idea is to bring people from different disciplines, like you described, from chemistry, from math, from physics, from biology, obviously, across biology, and to study biological questions in this kind of interdisciplinary way. And it is located in the Crocker Science Center on campus of the University of Utah. And, there's a really nice shared space for a lot of groups working together and a lot of the modern, very, I wouldn't say just modern, but cutting edge equipment also in this building. So it's a really nice center for a lot of this kind of effort.
Yeah, physics, chemistry, biologists all working together. Take a couple minutes and talk about your fascination with the coronavirus and how that led to you and Savine grabbing the genomic sequencing recipe and building this molecule and then going out and getting this grant. Tell us about that.
Oh, so that's Savine's. That's just a minor. So fascination is one way to describe it. Dread is another. But I mean, it's something that's on all of our minds, I think. And ultimately, the genome for this virus has become known, which opened up a lot of opportunities for studying it in ways that would otherwise be unavailable. And so, you basically can build essentially a packaging for the virus without the internal, without the genome. And so then basically that is not as scary anymore. It cannot actually go and infect and cause a pathology. And so you can basically then study it quite directly with a lot of the tools that we have at our disposal. So my research normally focuses on exactly looking at how single molecules behave and their dynamics and how that depends on temperature. And so Savis has been studying other types of viruses with also really advanced biophysics tools. And so we at some point got together and realized that there was this unique opportunity to do something about this, and we went for it.
Yeah, so the National Science Foundation and their rapid response research, I mean, we think of these large institutions, especially when it comes to grants, as being very slow in being able to issue grants, and even the application process is quite arduous and long. But what was the process for securing this, over probably a period of weeks?
So it's been incredibly fast, the vision came together very quickly, and over the course of literally, you know, 2 days of discussions, we quickly wrote the grant and communicated with the NSF, and we received a clear communication back, and the grant was approved in record time, and overall the process took, it depends on how you count in terms of there are different milestones there, but ultimately we're talking about between 10 days and a couple of weeks. It was incredibly fast. And it goes beyond that in the sense that we maintain contact with the NSF, and it's been incredibly productive as well, in the sense that these particles that we're making allow a lot of different studies, not just what we're doing, and so there's a lot of collaborative potential there, and so we're very excited about that as well.
So there must be a lot of people across the rapid response research in various places throughout the country and the world studying this same sort of question, because as we know, it's on everyone's minds that COVID-19, the coronavirus, stands a chance of sort of dying out. We're not seeing as big of a prevalence in those really warm equatorial countries, and you know, where it's summer right now in the southern hemisphere. So what can you tell us about what you already know?
Well, so there are quite a few things that are already known, in the sense that you know, even from the very beginning, there was some parallels that one could draw to other viruses in the same family, the coronaviruses, or viruses that are not in the same family but somehow similar, like flu, and a lot of them are showing some seasonal dependence. So it was a kind of a natural guess that there might be something there. And there are, you know, like you mentioned, there are studies of, you know, how just epidemiological studies, basically, how this depends on the evolution of the pandemic as we're seeing it. But also, there are some there's some really beautiful work that recently came out, looking at the temperature and humidity dependence of, you know, an entire titer of the virus. So basically taking some source of the virus, some infected animal, and looking at how that large cohort of viruses, how they die out in different conditions. And so there's some indications that that there is some dependence on temperature and humidity, but it's still unclear exactly what that dependence is, and ultimately what we don't understand is what that does to individual virus particles. What is the mechanism for the virus to actually fall apart? And so that's kind of where we are very interested to find out those kinds of questions and answers, obviously.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Michael Vershin. He's the assistant professor from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah. Michael, along with assistant professor Saviz Safarian, have received the National Science Foundation Rapid Response Research Grant to study the structure of SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus strain at the center of the pandemic. You know what I wanted to ask you, Michael, is that there's a lot of information out there. Some of it's science-based, some of it's, well, frankly, rhetoric. You know, that this virus will remain alive and contagious on various surfaces. Some people say 2 days. Recently, the people on the boat from the Princess Cruise said as long as 14 days. Will your research, when you're working with this molecule, and we'll talk about these electron tweezers in a minute, but when you're doing your research, will you be able to ascertain how long this thing will be able to stay on various surfaces and actually get some science to this question?
Yeah, so I think that's the goal. And I think it was actually 17 days rather than 14. But that study is actually interesting because they found traces of RNA, which is the genomic material in this virus, on the surface. But it wasn't clear whether it was the full virus and whether it was infectious. So that kind of leads to what the work we're doing, because ultimately the question is, how does it fall apart and what remains behind? And basically, that's exactly the kind of information you don't learn unless you look. So that's exactly the case that we're trying to connect the dots between. Okay, there might be some dependence, but then what does it actually do? How does it actually work? And moreover, because we can make this ourselves, then you can actually start eventually. That's not necessarily the highest priority, first priority, but then you can start asking, what is it about the virus that makes it fall apart, you know, the specific parts of the protein and so forth. So there's a tremendous amount of power you gain by using this approach, and you can answer a lot of questions going forward with this approach.
On January 1st, the Chinese government released the recipe for the current coronavirus that they had, you know, the A, B, C's, D's, E's, and G's, you know, basically the genomic sequencing. Has that changed very much since that original recipe in the way of a mutation, in the way of the way that the virus performs?
So two answers to that question. One is that I am not an epidemiologist. I'm a biophysicist. But there are databases that your listeners can go access that are open to the public, which actually document point mutations and as they accumulate in the virus, because the genetic testing is proceeding in different populations, as we gain more information about where the patients are, there's more testing, and the genetic evolution of this virus is being documented, and these databases are available, including to your listeners. Anybody can go and look, and so yes, there's been certainly some changes accumulating. But they're still pretty small, as far as I know. The virus is still pretty young.
Yeah. Do you know offhand the name of those databases or how we can find those?
I could communicate later, not offhand. I could communicate, and you could probably post it on your website at some point. But they're not offhand.
Okay.
I'm curious about what else other researchers are doing within your group at the University of Utah when it comes to, I mean, there are so many facets of the coronavirus that can be studied, so many answers we don't have. What else is being studied?
So we have received inquiries of collaboration. We're interested in those across pretty much the entire campus of the University of Utah, from medical school to the College of Science, to engineering, and it's been quite incredible. So some questions have to do with the fact that one of the ways that the virus spreads is when you cough or sneeze or talk or sing, you produce you expel air from the lungs, and that brushes over the mucus in the air pathways and lifts some of the particles of mucus which have embedded in them the virus. So the virus is not necessarily in water, but in a more complex environment. And so there's a lot of questions about how that affects its life cycle. So that's one example, but there are many examples of epidemiological questions and the immunology questions that are being asked across the campus. It's really the mathematical modeling of how this pandemic is evolving and what we can expect. There are a lot of interesting questions that are being asked at various stages of progress. I'm just aware of basically an enormous number of people on campus mobilizing to study this problem from all kinds of angles.
Yes, well, and that raises a question, an enormous number of people. So are you all... because it is such an essential service, you're all sort of gathered in these labs, or how is that working? How are you performing these studies and also achieving social distancing?
Well, some studies can be done from home, especially from what I understand from some of the communications I've seen, some of the mathematical studies can be done from home, for example, or at least by remote work. But some of them do require physical presence. And so, yes, first of all, the university monitors very carefully which research is essential. And essentially, you basically identify the personnel that has to be involved. Everybody else stays home. And there is a lot of emphasis on wearing protective equipment that is appropriate and essentially minimizing presence as much as possible. You basically try to limit the exposure in every way you can. And so we take the safety very seriously. I can really speak for my lab, but I think this is this from what I'm seeing and from what I'm reading from communications and so forth. This is top down. Everybody is on the same page.
Historically, annual flu shots are sort of a crapshot where a year before people, WHO, CDC, I'm not sure the different organizations, they come together and they say, this is what we think might be hitting North America in the next flu season. And sometimes they hit the mark and sometimes they miss it completely. And so correct me if I'm wrong on that, but with the new genomic sequencing and the new tools that you have available to you through technology, will we be able to better ascertain what that next year's flu or influenza will look like so that we can design and build the flu shot that will have a better chance of knocking it down?
Well, so flu is somewhat of a different question in the sense that it's a different type of a virus. And in general, like you said, I think from what I understand, it's somewhat hard to make a perfect flu shot. And so I don't know what will change about that next year. As far as the SARS-CoV-2, there's certainly a lot of effort to try to understand how it would potentially evolve and what we can expect. But again, making predictions about what we'll be able to achieve within a very specific time frame like that is challenging.
So you and Saviz have a lot of questions you're trying to answer. What is the question, if there was one question you wanted to get answered, what would that question be that you are most curious about as you tackle this?
I think the big picture question here is, how does this virus fall apart? Now, that's an umbrella question in a sense that clearly corresponds to different conditions, like environmental conditions and different surfaces. So there is a lot of aspects to this. But fundamentally, we think we have a way of probing this question in a very fundamental and basic way, because we have access to basically the shell of the virus, and actually even more than that. So we can basically not only probe it from outside and see how it falls apart, but actually start to in an informal language to twiddle with it, and how it's made up, to see how it falls apart and what actually holds it together. So that's the big question.
And for our Star Trek fans out there, these electronic tweezers, this whole tractor beam, I think, is something that you is a way that you described it. Can you just talk about that before we let you go?
Well, so they're optical tweezers. So actually, the idea is that If you want to manipulate things on the nanoscale, on the scale of individual molecules, then you need a way to hold things and manipulate things. And in many cases, you want to hold and manipulate many different things. So it's really convenient that to use light, because you don't have to reach in with actual tweezers. If you can just picture 10 tweezers reaching in, trying to hold 10 different things, that doesn't quite work. But with light, you can do that, because light goes through other light, just superposition principle. So you can basically make something that acts like a tweezer, is able to hold things in place, but you can do many, many things at the same time. And so that allows a lot of flexibility for us. And it's a, you know, it's a discovery that initially happened at Bell Labs in the essentially in the 70s and evolved through the 80s, and it's recently won a Nobel Prize. We're just using that technology. It's very well established. Some of the stuff that we're doing is our own custom modifications, but there's a lot of labs using optical tweezers to great effect across the United States and the world.
Just fascinating. Michael Vershin is our guest, assistant professor, Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah. Michael, and also assistant professor Sevi Safarian, have received the National Science Foundation Rapid Response Research Grant to study the coronavirus and see if we can figure this out. You're doing really important work. We wish you absolutely the best.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Michael.